evening. I am so always humbled by that song. If you think about the power of that song and the tightness with which it was written, and you know, there's just something about talent when it comes to such a thing. I mean, Beethoven and the words that were written. I know years ago, for a sermon purpose and others, I studied the history of the story of Handel's Messiah. And it's one of those masterpieces of music that basically is a symphony and opera that talks all about, you know, the story of Christ and the way in which everything is done in the Bible, and verse after verse kind of goes on and on about it. At the end, it's all about, you know, the great triumph, hallelujah, at the end. And so it's a fascinating thing to be able to hear songs like that. I think certain songs certainly separate themselves from others, and that one's definitely one of them. Imagine singing that with 1,000 people. I just think it would be incredible. So, good evening. So, last Wednesday night, I was rushing through the end of Zechariah 14, which, of course, is a huge mistake. You can't possibly teach a book like that or in a chapter like that and rush through the end. And so I found myself kind of skimming through some pretty fascinating details at the end of the book that I'd like to share with us tonight. I got a lot of comments after the class that said, hey, you know, that was great. You know, too bad we had to rush through it and kind of a thing. Well, the faithful remnant that's here tonight gets to listen to some more thoughts on this, because again, like anything else that you study over time, it teaches you that there's some great wisdom in it, and I thought I'd share it with you tonight. We talked throughout the study of the book of Zechariah how it was all about encouragement, all about trying to motivate the people. You know, we have a theme this year, this idea of a heart to work, and we selected books like Ezra and Zechariah and Haggai and Nehemiah, and eventually, Lord willing, at the end of the year, we're going to study James. And when you get through some of these books and you can see, you know, so much detail about the history of what they were dealing with and whatnot, that it's important to see and come away from this with a really strong understanding of what he meant by the faithful remnant. And we know what this term often refers to. You know, when they were put into captivity, Assyrian and then eventually Babylonian captivity, we know that most of the nation of Israel, the chosen people of God, had been destroyed. And only the faithful remnant, after 70 years in captivity, come back. And they've got some challenges, like Kyle mentioned in his sermon on Judges this morning. You know, the cycles of good and bad and faithfulness and not. You know, it's the cycles of life that we go through. But what was really fascinating to me about the last several verses, 16 through 21 of Zechariah 14, is the connection it makes with the Feast of Tabernacles. It's not generally something that we study, but it is something that we did focus the VBS on it last year and taught the kids, I hope, and us, the rest of us, a valuable lesson about what it means to the faithful remnant of God to remember him. And what does that mean in our Christian lives today? And so, with the time we have allotted tonight, I'd just like to go through some of my notes. When I study something like this, I try and just research as much as I can and come up with a lot of things and copied and pasted a bunch of stuff in here. I give credit to the people who I'm, you know, quoting here and other thoughts of mine. So the thought is just to kind of do a little more of an in-depth look at the last several verses of Zechariah 14. So it begins in chapter 14, verse 16, talking about the nations worshiping the king. We'll just read verses 16 through 21. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the feast of the tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. In that day, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved on the bells of the horses. The pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yes, every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holiness to the Lord of hosts. Everyone who sacrifices shall come and take them and cook in them. In that day, there shall no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord. Throughout the study, as Scott instructed us in the beginning of the study of this chapter, there's a lot of things that are prophetic, a lot of things that are speaking towards the prophecy to the people in that day for their encouragement in that day. But there's also a lot of things that are talking about a future, a time in which God will reign in the church, and all of the nations shall be under a different rule, the rule of the gospel, this better covenant that was built upon better promises. And we talk about this stuff all the time. But oftentimes people will, and we tried to point out in the as we conducted ourselves through this class, that a lot of times people will go to certain passages like this, and certainly the rest of the chapter of the book, chapter 14 of Zechariah, and talk about a physical restoration of Jerusalem, this physical restoration of God's people, and that all these people will come back to Jerusalem, and the concept in Revelation where, you know, Jesus will come back and the thousand-year reign and this whole concept of premillennialism comes out of that. And one of the things that I found in my research and studying this is that it is everywhere. Lots of different commentators speak about this issue. They struggle with trying to put these pieces together and understand it in the way that I believe it's being taught here, which is about the final remnant, the future church, the time in which those few that choose the narrow path, those that commit themselves to God, will conduct themselves. And so let's kind of go through this a little bit and see if we can make a connection to this. And I think that's why the Feast of Tabernacles is mentioned so many times as we go through our study tonight. So in verse 16, for us, this is a reference to the church in the present age. This is my opinion of what this is talking about. It's about those who accept the gospel of Christ and keep the duties and ordinances of his church. It's not about a physical restoration as some might see it. Now, we are talking about a time, 500 or so BC, where these things are being talked about in reference to the people of the time of Zechariah, whom he's preaching to. They had a job to do. There were things that they needed to complete. The tabernacle, the temple, wasn't built. And so he's calling to encourage them. And I think throughout this, I kept thinking to myself about our theme this year, about having a heart to work. How is Zechariah going to be effective with the people if he isn't going to teach them these things on their hearts, and that their hearts aren't going to come to know about it, not only in their present time, but as it relates to us so many thousands of years later, to the fulfillment of this in the church? When he makes the connection to the tabernacles, I think you'll see it. So the question I asked myself when I made this conclusion on verse 16 is, how do I know this? How do I know that it's referenced to the church in the present age? Why would I not take the opinion of so many others that you can read about that look at this premillennialism idea that Jesus is going to come back and the few nations of the earth, Jesus will have control of them on the earth, and this idea is that he'll reign for 1,000 years. Why is that not, you know, what the right interpretation of this would be? And I think this is why I came to this conclusion. So how do I know this? I know this because the Feast of Tabernacles is used as an illustration. I want to describe a little bit more about what this means. It's powerful. And when we studied the Feast of Tabernacles, we talked about it. And so as we can go forward on this, I want you to think about how we can know what this is teaching and why God used this concept of the Feast of Tabernacles as an illustration. Any literal interpretation or acceptance of this verse as a pledge that God will destroy the whole world except a remnant of Jews in every nation, and that the entire physical earth shall journey 3 times a year to physical Jerusalem to live in tents for a week, must be accounted as a preposterous misunderstanding. Think about it. If truly this is what Zechariah is talking about, then this is what the fulfillment of it would be. What was the Feast of Tabernacles? You know, we need to understand some of these things. And when we're rushing through the last on a Wednesday night class and we start throwing all this stuff out at people, it's kind of hard for people to understand. So let's slow down for just a second and think about this. Is that really what he's talking about? Can I be sure that I know that he's talking about the spiritual church and the spiritual kingdom? Well, if I think he's talking about the physical, this is the conclusion I must come to, and I don't think that's what it says. So as we go forward, let's talk about this. What was the Feast of Tabernacles? The Jews had 3 original annual festivals: the Feast of the Passover in commemoration of their departure from Egypt, the Feast of Pentecost in commemoration of the giving of the law upon Mount Sinai, and the Feast of Tabernacles in commemoration of their wandering 40 years in the wilderness. They were to keep these ordinances every year. They gave specific dates within the year in which they were to do this. We spent a whole VBS talking about this with our kids, trying to say to them, why did God have them remember their wanderings in the wilderness? Why do we have God say that they needed to come back, the men at least, needed to come back and live in tents and booths to remember their dependence upon God? Why is this so important in the time period that the Bible is writing it? And why is Zechariah using it, especially if we consider it to be in connection with the fulfillment of the church in the dispensation of time that we're in now? These things have to have some sort of association with each other, and proper Bible study can help us get through this to understand it better. One of the commentators I read, I mentioned him here, James Kaufman, said, this last feast, the Feast of Tabernacles, in this passage, this context in Zechariah 14, is used to point out the final restoration of the Jews and their establishment in the gospel of Christ after their long wandering in vice and error. Think about the history of the Jews. In the time that this is being written, they had just come back from 70 years in captivity in Babylon. They were restoring the temple. They were living in paneled houses and things that they weren't doing the work that God had set before them. They needed to know the importance. We've talked about Zerubbabel, the governor of this group of people as they're writing in this time of Zechariah. Zerubbabel, as we study the lineage of Christ, is in the actual line of Christ. Christ is in the same line as Zerubbabel. There's a connection. The faithful remnant, God is protecting them, and he's teaching them in this time of the tabernacles, and in this illustration that's being used in Zechariah 14 about the eternal covenant that God has with his people, that he will continually keep his people in his care as long as his people remember him, that they keep him and his ordinances in their lives. The ordinances we have in the New Testament are the commandments of God that are given. The idea about partaking of communion on the first day of the week, the idea about loving the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and your neighbor as yourself, all the different things that we're taught about in the New Testament dispensation, these are the same things. So when he's using this illustration as we see it here, he's telling the people to remember me as a Christian in the 21st century, just like I wanted them to remember me in this time, that you will keep this idea in your mind, that this is what I want of his people. So this illustration is important, and as Kaufman points out here, it's used to point to the gospel of Christ time. So let's talk about this word sukkah. It's an interesting word, and it's the actual word that's translated as tabernacles or booths. Both are attempts to translate sukkot into English. The singular form is sukkah. Now, this is what's interesting about this. Think about this word as it relates to our theme and our topic of the sermon tonight. A sukkah is a makeshift shade from the sun made from readily available materials. For example, during the harvest season of late summer, a laborer might rise early and work throughout the morning. Then, as the oppressive midday sun beats down, he takes a break. Using leftover plant stalks, leaves, and branches, he constructs a simple shelter to provide him with shade. Jonah also built such a sukkah to sit in as he waited to see what would come of Nineveh in Jonah chapter 4, verse 5. Jacob built a sukkah for his cattle and journeys and actually named the place after them in Genesis chapter 33. The idea behind this is that when the people left Egypt, we've read recently about the fact that they left in haste. The whole concept of the Passover was for them to be prepared so that when the angel passed over and the firstborn was killed, you'd be protected, but they immediately got up and left. So when they left, what was going to protect them? Whatever they could find. Certain things that they could find along the way, but they're in the desert. So how are they going to be protected from these things? If you think about the idea of tabernacles and sukkah, this idea of protection and shade and something that's provided to you, and you see this as an illustration in Zechariah to talk about a time when sin is rampant in the world and there's only one way in which man's going to be protected from sin, and that's in the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, that it's talking exactly about this time. The protection, the sukkah, the Feast of Tabernacles being used in this illustration to point to a time when man is going to be in a relationship with God where he needs the same kind of protection as they were given in this physical illustration. So Zechariah is basically telling the people in his day, and a prophecy that we can look at, and one of the interpretations of that prophecy in our day, is that we are to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, in the sense that we keep the ordinances of God, and when we do, they protect us, that we are protected from these things. The faithful remnant will always be. Well, if you're not a faithful remnant, if you're not obeying the ordinances of God, if you're not in that right relationship with God, then there's a problem, right? That's the issue that is being discussed here. And it's a beautiful illustration if we look at the meanings of these words. So verses 17 to 18, I'll restate them for you here just so we can remember what they said. And it shall be that whichever the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the king, again, remember, this is the idea of the tabernacles, is they needed to come to Jerusalem to worship the king, and they needed to observe this feast. Do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Again, remember, books like Zechariah have dual meanings. They have a meaning to the people of the time, and they have a messianic prophecy and a messianic fulfillment in the current times. So how do we come to understand what this means? Verses 17 and 18, those that do not, on them there will be no rain. Rain is a metaphor representing the precious showers of God's grace upon his people. When, if you need to be, if you're a farmer, or if you're a person who lives off of water, which all of us do, this idea of not obeying God, not fulfilling his ordinances, on you there will be no rain. There's a consequence to the actions. Those who do not keep the Feast of the Tabernacles in this sense are going to not have any rain. That's the implication. Who do not say, they know that there is a God, they know that God has a value and a purpose in this life, but they choose with this knowledge not to fulfill the ordinances of God. Upon them there should be no rain. It's a very strong metaphor and a very strong purpose of the consequences of not heeding the things that God says to us. In this sense, the keeping of an ordinance of God, whether it be the tabernacles or whether it be a New Testament requirement that we have to worship God and all the things that we're supposed to keep ourselves free from sin. So what does this have to do with the Feast of the Tabernacles? This is the idea of a heart to work and where I really wanted to take our discussion tonight. Consider our hearts to work for God. Do we observe his ordinances today? God protects us and provides for us as we wander through the wilderness of this life and has given his son, his precious word, and his church to protect us. This is where I really tried to make the connection between what we were studying in Zechariah and the purpose for studying it and our theme for the year. This idea of the Feast of Tabernacles was what? I have a heart. My heart is going to motivate me to travel to Jerusalem to live in a tent for 7 days. For what purpose? The idea behind it was what? If I asked one of the kids that was at VBS, what was the whole theme? Why did they have to live in tabernacles? Do you remember? What was the reason? What did they have to do? I had sticky notes all over me and I couldn't do something. What couldn't I do? I couldn't remember names, remember? Do you remember? The idea was to remember. So they're in these booths. Think about their lives. They had other things that they were doing. They're busy like the rest of us and things to do. So they were said, listen, stop, take a moment of your life, develop a heart to commit yourself to coming to Jerusalem and living in a booth to remember what God had done for you. It's about perspective. It's about getting their hearts right. How are the people in Zechariah's time or the time that Haggai is preaching to going to complete the work that God has for them if they don't get their hearts right first? Anything that we do in life, no matter what it is, always is about trying to get our hearts right first. If we get our hearts right first, we will strive to be unified. If we get our hearts right first, we will be willing to reach out to our neighbor, to teach others as we have opportunity. Everything about this idea of remembering God, about pausing and slowing down, has to do with this idea of the Feast of Tabernacles, has to do with this idea of having a heart to work. And so I saw a really strong connection here and thought that I would point it out. And I think that's what Zechariah is getting at. So in my studies, I came across this guy. You've probably heard of him before. He's a Catholic priest. His name was Jerome. This is a famous painting that you can't see very well. It was he lived in the 4th century. He lived in Rome, and he's responsible for translating. He's best known for his translation of most of the Bible into Latin. The translations later became known as the Vulgate. What was interesting about my research on this guy is that, you know, this painting shows him in his study, and the idea of him, you know, doing this very difficult translation into the Latin form. But what was interesting about it is he wasn't a Christian, wasn't a faithful person in earlier parts of his life. He became a Christian. He became somebody who went to Rome and had studied all these things in Rome under this very affluent time. But because he didn't understand the people and he didn't know about the lives of the people, he actually moved to Jerusalem during this process to learn about the people, to learn about the unique nature of their language, about their customs. The thing about Bible study is it's often difficult for us when we see the incredible confusion that comes through the words on page in a book like Zechariah to get lost and just get that deer in the headlights look like, whew, I'm not going to get this. Well, it takes a lot of study. It takes a lot of application of yourself to it to understand the cultures and the words. Words like sukkah, words like the concept behind the Feast of Tabernacles. What's he talking about? If he's talking about remembering, and how is he making this as an application in New Testament times? It's a fascinating thing, and guys like this I respect in the fact that he took the time to study the language, to translate it, but when he didn't understand it enough, he moved himself to Jerusalem to get more immersed in the culture. He said this idea about the Feast of Tabernacles is expressed in Leviticus chapter 23, 41 to 43. This is where the commandment or the ordinance is given. But this is Jerome's interpretation about this concept. He says, think about this. In the vast, wide, terrible wilderness, where was no village, house, town, cave, it made itself tents, wherein to sojourn with wives and children, avoiding by day the burning sun, by night damp and cold, and hurt from dew. And it was, quote, a statute forever in their generations. Ye shall dwell in booths 7 days. All that are Israelites born shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. The thought that keeps bouncing through my head on that is what devotion, what emphasis that God had on making sure that people understood that God was the one who saved them from Egypt. God was the one who protected them. And if you're struggling in the time of Zechariah and Haggai and you're not getting the temple done and things of that sort, God sends a prophet like Zechariah to remind the people of the day that this was the reason God said to remember me. This was the reason he said to stop and dwell in tents, to remember that I brought you out of Egypt. Be grateful for the salvation, you can say, that I gave you from slavery in Egypt to make you a people to have these great things come through. That's an application to them at the time. But the application is also to us in the New Testament time period to say that we have the same. When you have connections made between the Feast of Tabernacles and obeying them to the ordinances of God today in the Christian dispensation, you see a much stronger connection between the two. At least that's what I believe Zechariah is trying to get to. So in verse 19, there are consequences. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of the Tabernacles. If we're seeing this, as a New Testament, a messianic, you should say, a future church time prophecy, then the consequences for those who do not keep his ordinances are such. There should be punishment for those that do not. Verse 19, Egypt here is used as a type, this idea of a representation of all people who, quote, forget God, reject his offer of salvation from the consequences of sin. This is the greater context, the greater meaning of what Zechariah is trying to get to. Think about this, Matthew chapter 26. This is a very interesting passage because this is the context of Judas and how it was that Judas and Christ had this very interesting dialogue. He answered and said to him, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. The Son of Man indeed goes just as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born. Then Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, Rabbi, is it I? And he said to him, you have said it. The idea behind this is the punishment, the consequence of the knowledge of the people that had this knowledge and who rejected him are going to have punishment. Judas knew. He knew that he was going to betray him. And this idea is that all the exposure that Judas had to the teaching and the preaching of Christ, think about it. He walked with Christ for all those years. He knew all the intimate things that were going on. He had this great knowledge, and what did he do? He rejected it. This is this idea of Egypt, this idea of a prosperous nation who put the Jews into slavery for 430 years of their existence. They lived in Egypt under the oppression of the pharaohs, and they are this type, this great amalgamation of people who forgot God, and that's what I think Zechariah is getting to here, that there will be punishment upon all of these peoples who forget him, and that could be us too, just like Judas, who've heard the things that God has taught and are being punished because of it. So the last two verses here, again, just fascinating to me. So let's just go through this as well. So chapter 14, verse 20. In that day, and again, we said in this chapter, there were 16 different references to in that day. And again, in that day, I believe is referring to into the dispensation of time that we're in now, the Christian, the gospel age. Holiness to the Lord, listen to this, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved on the bells of horses. The pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bulls before the altar. Yes, every pot in Jerusalem, Judah, shall be holiness to the Lord of hosts. Everyone who sacrifices will come and take them and cook in them. In that day there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. This is often one of those passages, it's like, what does he mean? What's he talking about? Why the emphasis on the holiness of the Lord? This is where we have to be Bible students. It's just the way it is. You have to research this to understand what he's talking about. Verses 20 and 21, the artificial distinction between the sacred and the secular would be broken down. This is important. Everything, even the most common things, such as kitchen utensils, would be recognized as sacred because all of life is sacred. Zechariah is prophesying that there's now a new meaning for what is sacred to God. And this is important. Look at this verse, and I have the wow, so cool on there because I guess I'm a geek that way. This is Exodus chapter 28. This exact phrase right here, holiness to the Lord, is in this passage. But look what it's talking about in this context. Is it coincidence that Zechariah is using the very same phrase? Answer to that question is always no. Exodus 28, verse 36. You shall also make a plate of pure gold and engrave on it, like the engraving of a signet, holiness to the Lord. Who's he talking about here? This is the high priest, Aaron. You shall put it on a blue cord, that it may be on the turban. It shall be on the front of the turban. So it shall be on Aaron's forehead, Aaron the high priest. And Aaron may bear the iniquity of holy things, which the children of Israel hallow in all their holy gifts. And it shall always be on his forehead, that they may be accepted before the Lord. This idea of this pure engraved on it, and the holiness to the Lord, was only on the forehead of the high priest. During the time of the Jews in the Old Testament times, under the Levitical priesthood, only the high priest could wear holiness to the Lord on his head. He was distinguished. Only the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies. Only the high priest had access, so to speak, to God. But how many times have we taught about the crucifixion of Christ? What happens? The veil is torn in two. Man now has direct access to God. Through what? Through the blood of Christ. How do I know Zechariah is talking about this event and not this premillennial concept of a physical Jerusalem being restored? Because God is very particular about connecting these things together for our understanding. That's why I think it's cool. We can understand in that way. A popular writer, I found this is another guy I found in my studies, in the first half of the 20th century, pointed out that Christianity greatly expanded the view of what is sacred or not sacred. Think about this. Zechariah is talking about common things, and Exodus is talking about unique and specific things to only the high priest. This guy had a very interesting take on this. There's no sacred sex anymore because the gospel's neither male nor female in Christ. There's no sacred language. The many, quote, tongues of Pentecost describe that. We had a conversation today about Babel and about how the Tower of Babel confused their language, yet in Pentecost, on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, they were all hearing in different languages. There's no sacred place, neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem. Again, think about the way the gospel looks at things. There's no sacred dress or clothing. All are clothed in the righteousness of Christ. There's no sacred occupation, high priest or layperson. Zechariah is writing in a time where these things still exist this way. But he's talking about a time in the gospel dispensation of Christ where they won't. Where God's plan is always to prophesy towards a time where these things won't be that way. But the concepts are still the same. Remember the inscription on the bells of the horses. A bell on a horse was this idea of a working thing. When the horse was working and walking through the field, or so they could understand where the horse was going to be or going, it was a very common utilitarian working kind of thing. But now the inscription in Zechariah is going to be on the bells of the horses. It was equal to the adornment of the high priest. This is what's fascinating about this connection between these two verses, and I'm hoping you're seeing it as I'm trying to present it. And so finally, in this last verse, it talks about the Canaanite, which is another interesting word study. This is a word of special interest. It means trafficker or merchant. And if we go back, I should probably go back where we can read what it said. Hang on. Where did it say? At the last rite, everyone who sacrifices will come and take and cook them. In that day, there shall no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. So if you look at the word, and the word is defined as a merchant or a trafficker, what does that impact does it have on this verse? What is Zechariah trying to say about that? In Hosea chapter 12, verse 17, the concept of Canaanite in this context stands for a wicked, profane, or idolatrous person. A cunning Canaanite, Hosea 12, 7 says, deceitful scales are in his hand. He loves to oppress. A lot of times, a lot of commentators that you read about talk about this, you know, preachers or others who have a different purpose of in their mind or different objective in their hearts, primarily purveyors of the Word of God for money, are the true Canaanites of the current era. And the suspicion is fully justified that there are many who fall into this category. If we preach God with impure motives, if we have a different, you know, ulterior motive, are we going to truly be in the house of God? Are we going to be truly adhering to the things that God has said? According to Zechariah's prophecy, in this time, that person may be able to dissuade and to change the hearts and minds of lots of people for his own personal gain. But they will not be unknown of God. God will know them and know that they are truly not in that right relationship. The bottom line about, I guess, the point of all this is that the Lord knows who are his own. And that's what the New Testament teaches. It teaches this in lots of different ways. And I believe that's why we can connect the things that Zechariah is saying to this New Testament gospel time to say that we truly can be right with God. We have to adhere to his ordinances. We have to follow them just like they were taught to follow them in the Feast of Tabernacles. And if we do, we will be right with God. Here's the admonition in 2 Timothy chapter 2. Think about these words as we conclude. Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal. The Lord knows who are his. Let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. This is this idea of adhering to the Feast of Tabernacles, of following after the ordinances of God. If we are a Christian person, the faithful remnant of God, we will be those who names the name of Christ. We will depart from iniquity. But in a great house, think about this, in a great house, there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay, some for honor and some for dishonor. Therefore, if anyone cleanses himself from the latter, he will be a vessel for honor. Anyone who adheres to the ordinances of God, as Zechariah is saying, they will truly be this faithful remnant, this new Jerusalem, as he said. From the latter, he will be a vessel of honor, sanctified and useful for the master, prepared for every good work. Flee also youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace, and those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient in humility, correcting those who are in opposition. If God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth, and then they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. Zechariah is making the very same admonition in his day for the people to not forget God, to have their hearts be right with God first, follow his ordinances, and follow after him, even though, as we've said many times, we may fall. As Kyle said this morning in the Judges, we go through cycles in our lives. But we don't want to be those upon whom no rain falls. We don't want to be those upon whom have not gone back to honor God in terms of our daily sacrifices, and especially in terms of our ability to gather together on the first day of the week, to partake of the Lord's Supper and communion, to encourage each other, to reach out to the faint-hearted. These are the New Testament examples of Old Testament ideas that are so consistent throughout the Bible that I found that to be very encouraging. I hope you see it as well. Passages like this can be very difficult to understand. Oftentimes we stay away from them because of it. I hope this will encourage us to be more diligent about trying to study the things of God and trying to understand them. And as I tried to warn us, and I warn myself, I can be subject to overkill, I guess, when it comes to trying to study these things. But if you, the internet is full of all kinds of ideas and opinions. And if you read something and just give somebody the benefit of the doubt that they know what they're talking about without being a true noble-minded Berean to check to see if these things are so, you get yourself in a lot of trouble. There's a lot of people who see these passages and interpret them in a completely different way. But if we weigh the entirety of the Bible together and see how it's talking about my kingdom is not of this earth, I go to prepare a mansion for you. And if it were not so, I would have told you. That's what we need to remember. Don't get turned around by this idea of, yay, Jerusalem's going to come back and it's going to reign for 1,000 years and going to have power on the earth. Why would we want that? Why would God want that? That doesn't make any sense. I'm sorry, it doesn't. But hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people may believe that or may be misled by that. Let's keep our focus on what it's trying to say and see the great encouragement in books like this. Hopefully this has encouraged you. If you have any questions about anything I said, please see Randy afterwards because you can... Seriously, I appreciate everybody's attendance. I know it's a difficult topic and lots of information. But if you're in need of the gospel in any way, encouragement, further encouragement, prayers, if you want to become a Christian, please let it be known as together we stand and sing.